WES has been active in support of the East Timorese people since 1975 and 1976, and actually got himself in a little bit of trouble with the Australian authorities occasionally with his efforts. WES, can you tell us about your boat? You had a couple of boats there at one stage.
Warwick's referring to our attempt to take medical supplies to East Timor. The unions and the bishops both said that they were going to breach the blockade the Indonesians had put on East Timor and take supplies over. Indonesia invaded East Timor in December 75, and there was probably something like 80 to 100,000 people killed in that first 6 months, and there was the country was blockaded. There was no medical supplies going in, no medical personnel, and so on. So both the unions and the bishops found it too hard, and they pulled out. So a small group of people tried to get another initiative going. They had two attempts. They caught up with me because I had volunteered before. We had two attempts with a completely inappropriate boat. And then they chartered a fishing boat and put in some money to get it going. And the skipper of the fishing boat was a master mariner, but he was a bit too clever by half because he thought that he could outwit the customs or the navy if they were onto us. We had some inkling they might have been, but we took some steps to try and find out and or to avoid them if they were. And unfortunately, we got caught. We hadn't really left Darwin Harbour.
A shipload of medical supplies, I understand.
That's right, a shipload of medical supplies and some food and some documents. And some codes for radio communication and some letters of well wishes and that sort of thing, and a couple of dinghies on board that we were going to go on shore with, and our crew included Cliff Morris, who'd been with the intelligence side of the commandos in World War II and had learnt Tetan. He was going to be our Tetan interpreter. But we got arrested, and they allegedly were looking for weapons, and of course there was none there, and they had a huge court case, 10 days in the magistrate's court, and customs officers said, we saw boxes being loaded that looked like they contained weapons, you know, this sort of rubbish. And the magistrate found us guilty of attempting to take stuff out of Australia without the permits to, you know, without export permits. Pretty minor thing, really. But he didn't impose any penalty, and he said that we were heroes, basically. He was particularly impressed with Cliff Morris, and it turns out that this magistrate's brother had been a commando or something like that himself, you know, so he was very supportive of what we tried to do. We appealed to the Supreme Court, and we had 3.5 days there, and the convictions were overturned on technical grounds. We had to appeal because the customs had seized this 48-foot fishing boat, which was worth a lot of money, and they had basically wrecked it. That then began a fight for restoring the boat and for compensation. Another long story.
And you did mention there were radio codes were part of the cargo, and I guess that had something to do with the infamous clandestine radio to the Fretland that was set up when...
Yes, well, Dennis Freeney and Brian Manning and people had foreseen that Indonesia would likely attack, and they took a transmitter to Fretilin, and when the Indonesian invasion took place, this radio went up the mountains and they were broadcasting with it, and we were tuning in to them right from, you know, from those times, but the outpost radio was passing on messages for quite a long time, and they refused to do it anymore, and then we had to... Our link was the only link, and we also talked to them on occasions, and they wouldn't give us a licence to transmit, so it became a clandestine operation for that part of it. And
pirate radio.
I suppose you'd call it pirate radio. Brian Manning and I would go bush, throw an antenna over a tree, and we'd have an hour or an hour and a half limit. During that hour and a half, I suppose we were a pirate radio. The rest of the time, we were not, you know.
What was the hour and a half limit? Was that being tracked down, or...?
It was a self-imposed thing to minimise the chance of them locating us, because we did prove that they had stations in the bush to try and direction find on our transmitting site. If they had three direction finding stations, they could cross those lines and get a location for where we were. And so if territory is a big place, so we're saying, well, let's say it takes them an hour or so to drive to where we are. If we can get out of there quick, smart, even if we have everything packed up, they can't prove that we were transmitting, and we can get out of there. And both Brian and I knew the top end bush fairly well. We had quite a few adventures there.
You were tracked by ASIO once, weren't you? You had to send a decoy vehicle out to get away.
Well, what happened was we went to a place near the research station where I worked, and they had it turns out that they had a direction finding station at the end of, in that area, sort of. They apparently put two and two together. We might go down there. And we called up and got no answer. So on the Timor side, they weren't ready to talk to us that day. And so we explored around the area a little bit on the way home just to, you know, check out future sites and so on. And we came across a direction finding station. And we were able to just sneak away without them spotting us in the car. And I came back the next morning and with a camera and everything and went in and photographed them, and the bloke got excited, and the next thing there's ASIO and local police and so on, and the district radio fellow there, and they desperately wanted to search my car, and when I established that they had no right to, I allowed them to, and they did, but they didn't actually look where we would have been hiding the radio anyway, so it was just a bit of fun and games. And I had a lot of documents about East Timor, and I said, are you interested in East Timor? And they said, oh, it's, well, just, you know, a little bit. I said, would you like some documents? I've got quite a few. And they said, oh, yeah, that'd be good. You know, we need some reading while we're out in the bush. And so I gave them all this kind of propaganda, really. And they were very grateful. But the radio people, they didn't want to stop us broadcasting. It was just a political decision, really, of the Fraser government. Yeah.
Okay. And just reading over some of the history, this was very, very important to the Fretilin right up until their own transmitter was captured.
That's right. Well, for nearly 3 years, this was the only source of news coming out where a nation's been invaded and nearly a third of its people are being slaughtered. It's incredible that free governments like Australia, you know, defenders of the brave and all that sort of thing, could allow a situation where our huge nation, 400 kilometres from tiny little East Timor, and not only did they not help, but they blockaded. They assisted with the blockade. So they tried to close down the radio. And this is the most significant aspect, I believe, of capturing our attempt to take medical supplies there. They blockaded it from aid going there. So who stops medical supplies going to injured and deprived people? I mean, that should be the greatest shame and disgrace.
Because the Indonesians weren't allowing International Red Cross in at that stage, were they?
No, well, I don't think they ever did. Eventually they allowed a Catholic mob from United States in for a while, and there was Indonesian Red Cross eventually, and I think when Peter Rogers from the Sydney Morning Herald went there as a diplomatic team, and he took some photos of these starving children, and there was an Indonesian Red Cross doctor, and he said, oh, no, they're okay, they're just a bit light on, and they're almost dead, you know. And those photos appeared in the Sydney Morning Herald, and that became I think he lost his job in the diplomatic corps, but that set of photos was the first real hard evidence to come out of Timor. It was a very important factor in alerting to the world what's going on.
So I guess this radio project was pretty critical in the years that it survived.
Yeah, I think it was. And one of the things that gave it a bit of status as well was your father, as the member of in Parliament for Fraser came up on at least two occasions and spoke on the radio, and it certainly gave the Timorese a lot of confidence that a fellow of his status was prepared to do that. And sitting in his old study, looking around, I see a photo of him doing that right now. And
with Brian Manning.
Great loss to us all that he's just passed away.
Well, thanks for that, Wes. So, Wes, you obviously you continued to be a very dedicated and very committed activist for East Timor, and apart from making numerous visits over there and giving them lots of advice, you're an agricultural expert.
Well, since 1999, I've been able to do that. Yeah, I wasn't able to before 1999. Yeah,
but during the time you were not allowed to go to East Timor, and I think the first time he took a bit of a risk, but you sort of engaged into all sorts of activities, including some street theatre. I remember hearing friends from Darwin talking about the time you tried to burn a dog.
Yeah, well, in fact, Horta keeps talking about that and says he's going to put it in a book and never does. And I'm looking across here and I see Horta with Ken and Audrey Fry there, and he tells me, oh, it was edited out of his book. But he was very enamoured of this project, which was to try and shame people, because Jimmy Carter's regime, and Jimmy Carter now is very shamed about this. They supplied weapons to Indonesia, even though they were not meant to. I think Henry Kissinger had a lot to do with that. I think Jimmy Carter was just conned. And they supplied these Bronco OV-10 aircraft, which are ground attack aircraft, and they used napalm from them. They napalm people, they napalm crops, they burnt the forest and so on. It's a good question to find out where did that napalm come from. You know, some people will say Indonesia had it, or it came from Vietnam to Indonesia. I think there's a good chance. What happened to Australia's stocks of napalm that they had during the Vietnam War, which finished just before this Indonesian invasion? In fact, you could say they're a linked issue. I'm not certain that they weren't handed over to the Indonesians and ended up being dropped on East Timor. Anyway, we devised this thing. It was for the 4th of July 1978, so American Independence Day, to put the onus back on America. We said that we're going to napalm a dog in the main park in Darwin City Central. And there's a lot of agitation about this. Even my brothers ringing me up from all sorts of places in the world saying, look, have you lost your beans? And I said, trust me, mate, you know, yes, but...
No dogs will be harmed
in the making of this program. There was a huge crowd there. I mean, haven't seen a crowd like that. They had snipers on the roof. They had fire brigades. They had Southern Television there. And I was still a public servant, so I knocked off at 1 o'clock, at 12 o'clock, and I walked up. And I went into Woolies and I bought this toy dog. And I had it in my shirt. And there was these young fellas there, young people who were the main organisers. I'd done got the publicity, I suppose. And I said to them, and it was very tense. And I said, would you like me to say something? I said, oh yeah. And they didn't even have a microphone, so I'm shouting to this crowd of hundreds and hundreds of people. And I pulled out this stuffed dog, and they realised they'd been conned. And half of them were relieved. There was little old ladies with blankets and so on to throw over the burning dog. You know, they were sort of relieved, and the other half felt deprived. So there's boo, hiss, and all this sort of thing. And the fire brigade had cranked up their engines, ready to go, and they wanted to give us a spray anyway. They were really furious, you know. People talk about it to this day because it made the point they cared more about the fate of one dog than 100,000 Timorese that were being killed with napalm. Yeah.
Very good point. Well taken.
Yeah, well, you know, we did quite a few innovative things. We even we reenacted the death of Roger East in 1995. We reenacted the killings of the journos at Ballybough. And when you see the video of that, those reenactments, it's obviously reenactments, but they still actually, you know, bring a little lump to the old throat. And I'm giving mentioning that as a segue into the fact that the coroner's report on the deaths of Ballyboy will be handed down on Friday the 16th of November. It's only 2 weeks away at the Glebe Coroner's Court, and that's going to be a massive day for a lot of Timor activists that have been involved right from the early days, especially, of course, the families, including Shirley Shackleton, and Jill Jolliffe was there on that issue, and many others have pursued that issue for many, many years. So I think watch out for that one.
Robert Wesley Smith, who's a long-term East Timor activist, and he just came back from East Timor 3 weeks ago. Welcome to Community Radio TuneIn FM, Wes.
Thanks very much, Warry.
There's been a bit of controversy lately about the Australian troop presence there and their behaviour, and especially in regard to Alfredo Reynado, who's one of the rebel breakaways that caused the crisis last year. And I understand you have some quite close contact with some of the people involved with those issues.
Yeah, well, he was interviewed by the Philip Adams team just the day I left Timor. He came to Darwin in 1995 as the captain of the little refugee ship, the only one that came out, and we dealt with his group in Darwin for a while. I didn't really get to know him very well, but I did meet him, and he's a very interesting fellow. There's a lot of history issues as to why he was in the bush, but given that he was in the bush and he was wanted for alleged crimes, he said, I'm quite happy to face those issues, but the other people who committed crimes need to face them too. I'm not going to be a scapegoat. He did, in fact, surrender once, but the judicial system was very slow to deal with his case, and he let a break out from jail and went to the mountains again. Now, the leaders of East Timor got fed up with him, really, roaming the countryside, being supported by the village folk in the western part of East Timor, much the same way as people defended the resistance people against the Indonesians, as a matter of fact. Same was one of his bases. He moved between Same, Swai and Imera, so that's two towns on the south coast, Imera up in the mountains. And
Same was where the shootout happened a few months ago between Australian troops and Reynado.
That's right. Same is a beautiful town up in the lower mountains, due south of Dili, and you go up the mountains to Melbisi and down to Same. I know it quite well from earlier work I did in Timor. He was there, and the army was there, and they in fact had attended the same restaurants on several occasions and so on. And they were negotiating with the Attorney General, Linguos Montero, I think his name is, and there is some controversy about whether those negotiations had run their full gamut. According to the Alfredo camp, they had a signed agreement which was to be taken down to Dili from Dili on the Saturday night, and they were blocked from going down, and they understood that meant that the SAS were going to attack Alfredo. Alfredo himself says, well, why set up an attack like this? I was eating the restaurant with you 2 days earlier, like this. But Horta and maybe Shinana, particularly Horta, I think was he the Prime Minister at that time, he got fed up and he said, right, capture him dead or alive. Now,
that was after an attack on a police station, or perhaps not an attack, but they did get hold of a lot of weapons. And
I think that's what provoked the Horta's decision to... He went to a police post near the border up in the mountains, sort of out from Emira, and came away with a number of long weapons, you know, rifles. And some police went with him. So the police that went with him said, look, he came there, we decided we'd follow him, we took our own weapons. Other people say he raided the place and took weapons, but what's the truth of that? I don't know. Several police, and these are special police, like border police, so paramilitary, really, they went with Alfredo. Alfredo was the chief of military police in the army when he disappeared into the bush. He said at the time, look, my role is to sort out problems within the military. So a lot of people look to him as their superior officer in that respect. What he was angry about was that politicians made decisions which took away his role in sorting out disputes between the military. In other words, between the, say, 700 military from that stayed in the military and the 600 from the West who called the Dissidents, and who'd gone on strike, more or less, and they said that they wanted a number of issues to be sorted out. I feel that instead of sorting those issues out, again, the politician lost patience. That was Maria Alkatiri, the Prime Minister. He ordered 700 to act against the 600. That's when all this mayhem started. Alfredo says he caused, that decision caused the deaths that happened at the time. So anyway, that's why some people support Alfredo from within the military. It gives him that sort of special status. Since he's been roaming the bush, he's become a slightly mythological character to a lot of the Westerners, because he's seen as this person that's standing up for whatever it is he's standing up for, you know. So he gets a lot of support from villagers from the West. That's how he stays alive, and ultimately how he avoids being caught by the Australian Army at the time that they were looking for him.
Is that the only reason he's avoided it? I mean, we've heard stories about the Australian Army having cups of tea or cups of coffee with him, or their military patrols almost announcing his presence. I mean, it's probably difficult for you and I to say, you know, how serious were the attempts to capture him, but there has been some eyebrows raised.
Oh, yeah. Look, the politicians wanted to negotiate with Alfredo, so the military didn't have a clear mandate to capture him. In fact, there was a meeting down near Swire somewhere, a several-day meeting, where Alfredo was invited to meet with the military and with the politicians. And the military, Australian military, didn't have a clear mandate to capture him all the time. This changed when he went to that police post and came away with the rifles and ended up back in Swire. Like, he still had meals in restaurants with the Australian military. The military surrounded Swire. They were there for about a week. Within that week, he still had a meal in a restaurant with the military. So, but it was just, I think, a day or so before the attack on him. I've forgotten exactly how many days before SAS attacked, that Horta lost patience and said, capture him dead or alive. Now, I've got an issue with Horta giving that order, because he's a Nobel Peace Laureate. And if Maria Alkatiri had given that order, I'd have less issue with it. But just that Horta's meant to be a, you know, peace at any price man. He's made all these incredible compromises with Indonesia, giving them impunity, quite frankly, and which I totally object to. And yet he says, capture this bloke, about whom there's a lot of feeling, capture him dead or alive. So the SAS came down, the locals knew that the attack was about to happen. They sent down armoured personnel carriers. I'm told that several hundred...
You spoke to some of these people who described that attack and how it happened.
Well, I did. I was the recipient of some information at the time, and I put it out on the international email list. I was being sent updates on stuff, because their side needed it to get out. So I did know some stuff from back in, I think it was in May, April, May. But the Philip Adams team interviewed Alfredo the day that I left Timor. Philip himself wasn't, he came home, his team interviewed him, and listening to that on Late Night Live last week, I heard the description of some of these things that I was going to tell you, you know. But the fact that 300 people came and surrounded the APCs is something I knew from earlier. And it was reinforced by Kito, who was interviewed by the Philip Adams team. And there was a lot of Same young people. Now, he explained that Same had been in the thick of massacres during the Portuguese time, when the Indonesians came in, during Intifet sort of time, the, you know, getting the Indonesians out, and they didn't want another massacre. And they were saying that to the ADF, but the Australian Defence Force. But the Australian Defence Force, acting as the International Security Force, ISF, that's the other big issue. Australia sent the first troops in, then they didn't want to hand them over to UN command. And in the end, the UN said, well, Australia's the nearest country, they were invited in, and they are paying all these costs, so we're not going to make too much of an issue of it. But in a situation like this, it becomes important. I wrote at the time, I'm angry about it, because Australia has had a brilliant record of defending the Timorese, especially in 99, 2000 and so on, with Interphet. Now, this would be the first time that they actually set out to kill a Timorese. There was no possibility of this being a capture. This was a killing operation. They had helicopter gunships, and they had armoured personnel carriers surrounding him, and they had these SAS people, and they have a policy, if they feel they're being threatened, they shoot to kill. Mm-hmm. So there was people standing around the general area where Alfredo was.
These are local people, local yes. supporters.
Yes, these are local people, and I don't know if they had weapons or not, if they even waved something in the direction of a... say there's a helicopter up there with a strobe light or something, a light coming down onto this person, and he lifts his arms up towards the helicopter, he's likely to get shot dead. Well, five of them did get shot dead.
Three of them were civilians. No?
And I understand that only two were from the armed party that was with Alfredo, you see. So, and at least one of them was wounded, and Quito and some other people... In fact, the Timorese Red Cross tried to go to his assistance, and the SAS wouldn't allow anyone to go near him. And this guy was crying out for help, and the cries got weaker, and then they stopped. Alfredo claims on the Philip Adams program that the SAS broke his neck. Now, who would know? I don't know. I don't know what his evidence for that is, but maybe he had a bullet through the neck or something, you know. But we don't know the information from that incident from the SAS side, or Australian Defence Force side. They don't provide that information to us. So if people speculate and get it wrong, well, I think it's the fault of the Army. They should be telling us exactly what happened. I mean, this is a very significant moment in Australian history, in my view. Our forces set out to kill a Timorese fellow. About half of the country regards as a hero. The other half probably despise him, but whatever. A lot of people regard him as a hero. And, of course, riots broke out in Dili when they heard about this. I would like them to be honest with us. In 1999, when I went to Same, led the first group into Same, and we weren't quite sure about some Indonesian militia, and they were, in fact, down still at the coast, at Batano. Batano, famous for Australia, because that's where they evacuated the soldiers in World War II. We took some rice to a village, people there who'd escaped from the militia in Batano. So I got back to Dili and reported that to the military. They went down, apparently they went down with two Black Hawk helicopters and arrested 18 militia. At a meeting a few days later, I asked the military what had happened about that. And this guy gets on his high horse and says, "This is classified information," you know, so on. I said, "Look, I'm the one that gave you the information. You know, at least tell me if you, you know." And no, he wouldn't talk to me. So, I mean, how bizarre is that? They want everything from us, but they won't give anything back. So they need to look at their own attitude.
Thanks, Wes. No wonder there seems to be a bit of a problem with, the former government, Fretland, and the Australian Defence Forces. And I think one of the main issues, too, is this refusal of the Howard government to make them responsible to the United Nations, that they are almost an independent force in their own right.
Yes, well, they go back to the documents that were agreed to before they went in. And there's a lot of pressure, and I think fair enough, at the time that they wanted to have the signatures of the Prime Minister, the President, and the President of the Parliament. And then they wanted a status of forces agreement to say what they could do and what they couldn't do. Of course, there should have been a provision to revise that because, you know, they came in as military, and after the first few days, the problem after that was basically policing. So you still see these guys with these flipping great machine guns, really, wandering around in their boots in the streets of Dili, and some kids throwing stone, and these guys lumber off up the street. They can't use their weapons because, you know, it's just inappropriate. They should be doing a policing role, so the status of forces agreement needs to be changed to get some of these guys in running shoes and batons.
Yeah. Oh, it's the old oxymoron of military intelligence, I guess, Wes.
Yeah, I think so, yeah.
Well, thanks, Wes, and thank you very much for talking to Community Radio, Toonoo FM. Do you have a word for the people of Nimbin?
Well, I have a cousin who spent a lot of years up at Lismore, he, in fact, was an Indonesian, fluent Indonesian speaker at the time of Interphet came in, was with the army, they wouldn't allow him to use his skills at that point, so he left. So I'll dedicate my thing to Rowan.
If you're out there, Rowan.
Yeah, and all the people up there, you know, keep up the pressure on this this government, and may we elect a much greener one